All right, so hello everyone. This is Cody McKibben from Thrilling Heroics. Today is our mentorship call for November 15th for Digital Nomad Academy. It's the 15th for most of you, depending on where you are in the world. But thanks to everyone who's called in to join us live on the call today. Today you're in for a very, very special call. We are lucky to have someone I really look up to. Our very special guest today is Mr. Rolf Potts. Rolf is quite an impressive travel writer, and he's the author of two books, Vagabonding, An Uncommon Guide to the Art of Long-Term Travel, and more recently, your second book is Marco Polo Didn't Go There. So how you doing, Rolf? Thanks for joining us.
I'm doing good. I'm talking to you from Philadelphia today.
Cool. Yeah, I was going to ask where you are in the world, in this little world we have today. Are you still currently basically on long-term travel? Like, are you permanently traveling throughout the year?
I'm not right now. I'm actually, for the first time in 15 years, I'm in one place for a while. I got a visiting writer gig at the University of Pennsylvania. So I'm doing some writing and some teaching here, and it's the first time in a long time that I know where I'm going to be in 3 months, you know.
Well, very cool. Well, thank you so much for making the time to share with us today. I really appreciate you agreeing to be on this call, and I'm really, really excited because your book was kind of one of the two biggest influences on me when I first got started with sort of this, you know, location independent and living abroad lifestyle. And so inside DNA, we've got about 75 students now that are all, you know, somewhere along the line trying to get to a similar point where they can build a business that allows them to be where they want to be, and you know, most of them are interested in traveling. So I'm really excited to have you here. Thank you very much.
I was going to say my pleasure. I'm going to try a microphone too. I'm talking without the microphone and now I'm talking with the microphone. Does that make a difference?
Is it with the mic now?
It's with the mic now.
Yeah, I mean, you're coming through just fine. I know sometimes, depending, because okay. I'm calling in from Thailand and people are calling in from all over the place on the conference call line, so sometimes it chops up a little bit. If you miss something I say, just let me know to repeat it and I'll do the same. But yeah, you sound just fine, so thanks. But yeah, to start us off, would you mind just giving a sort of a brief background, what you're about for people who aren't familiar with you, and maybe let us know, I don't know, did you have a past life, you know, quote unquote, prior to writing your books and entering the travel writer world?
I had a past life, but it's far enough in the past now that it feels like, you know, I've been doing the vagabonding thing for so long that my past life is very far in the past. But yeah, before I started traveling full-time and writing for a living, I did many different things. I mean, I went vagabonding right out of college, and then I worked in retail sales. I taught English overseas. But that was my last non-writing gig, was 2 years of teaching English in Korea, which is actually a great way to experience, you know, a faraway place. And we can talk about that more in detail later. But as far as what I'm about, and, you know, I'm sure you know me through Vagabonding, which is the book most people know me through, which is just a book about long-term travel. It's about traveling for a year, say, instead of a week or 2 years or 6 months. It's about getting away and having more than a vacation. It's about taking your dream trip, maybe mixing work and travel and just sort of living this life on the road where you're not bound to a certain place or a certain idea of how you live. It's sort of a way to experiment with new ideas of living. And the core philosophy is the notion that our truest form of wealth is our time, not our possessions or our monetary wealth, and that how you spend your time is more important and more fulfilling than how you spend your money or how you surround yourself with things. So it's about becoming rich in experiences. And I've done some journalism and some literary travel writing, but a lot of the core of what I've been talking about for the last 10 years or so is how to create and maintain this lifestyle and really travel in an uncommon way in order to live an uncommon life, I guess.
Yeah, well, I found it truly inspiring when I first read Vagabonding. I think it was 2006, 2007, 2008, I was on a plane I'm from Northern California, and at the time I was working a full-time job, but I took about a two-week break to go with a few close friends for a holiday trip, Christmas and New Year, 2007, 2008, to Spain. And I read your book while I was sitting on the plane to Spain. You know, like, I don't know, 14 hours of travel or something. And it just really opened my eyes to, you know, here's a guy who, yeah, has really experimented a lot and found a way to do things kind of in your own way and just live the way you wanted to. Would you, is there, like, how did you come across that idea? What in your past or in your upbringing or your studies made you interested in this kind of uncommon life, you know, and independent travel, and how did you come to this philosophy that was the impetus for the book?
Well, I think part of it lies in reading. You know, like when you read the book, you'll see that there's a lot of Walt Whitman in it, and David Thoreau, and a lot of philosophers going back to the Bible and the Upanishads. But I think it would be dishonest of me to say that I had this nice full formed philosophical plan that bloomed, you know, from the earth of my intellect, when in fact a lot of it early on was fear. I grew up in Kansas, right in the middle of the country, which is a nice place, but you just have fewer, it's a little bit less cosmopolitan, you have fewer people telling you that you can travel long term. Hard work is really enforced on you from an early age, as it is in many parts of the United States. And I was afraid, as I was getting into college and doing some part-time work, like in grocery stores and stuff, and sort of seeing this dull work that I was doing as a metaphor for what would be the rest of my life if I didn't think outside of the box a little bit. And so initially, just sort of out of fear that I would never have another chance to do it, I concocted this vagabonding journey around the United States, living out of a van in 1994. Just so I could scratch my travel itch and get it done. And I could, you know, work hard my whole life and not have to worry about travel. But in the course of traveling for 8 months around the United States instead of for 2 weeks or a normal vacation time, I realized how easy it was. I realized how cheap it was. I realized how going slow was preferable to trying to cram a bunch of sites in at once. And I kept reading, you know, I kept reading John Muir, some more Walt Whitman, and, you know, Jack Kerouac, and I realized that there's this whole other way of thinking, as I say in my book, that doesn't require that you be a student or a counterculture dropout or some sort of wild-eyed revolutionary, but just there's this common sense aspect to the fact that you can create your own recess time, I guess. You don't have to ask for an employer to give you time off. If you're just a little bit resourceful, you can create these big, wide-open swaths of free time where you can travel. And I think it's something that I obviously apply it to travel because travel is a passion of mine. It's something you can even apply to having more time for other things you like your family or your hobbies or something. And I think in the almost 10 years since Vagabonding has come out, we've had the location independent professional movement kind of come up, and it goes on the same principle that you just have this, you have this, that you take control of your time, basically, and you sort of shift your life in such a way that it pays off in free time. And so the philosophy sort of came through life experiences and then reading and then just really sort of getting into the philosophical core of myself and trying to figure out what I really wanted out of life.
And I know you reference, like, Walt Whitman a lot, and as you said, you mentioned Jack Kerouac and several other writers. Do you have two or three, like, top favorite books that really inspired you that you recommend people read?
Yeah, you know, a lot of those, as applied to travel, are in Vagabonding, in the resource sections of Vagabonding, which are also online at vagabonding.net/resources. The books that inspired me are very specific to the age that I was when I read them. So, like, I read Leaves of Grass when I was 23, I think. And it was just the right time for me to read that and realize that there's this certain spirit and sort of this certain attitude that you can take towards life And at a time when I may have otherwise been stressed out and been worried about forcing myself into getting a career and being a very serious person, I realized that, you know, life can be a wide open experience if you let it. And of course, On the Road was an influence on me. And there's some other books. You know, I spent a lot of time in Asia early on, so the travel writing of Pico Iyer or Paul Theroux sort of influenced the way I thought about travel, and also they influenced me as a travel writer. But if, you know, a good shorthand reading list as applies to travel and life philosophy for travel, those are in the resources of Vagabond, including spiritual readings, because there's, you know, ultimately there's sort of this spiritual aspect, this existential aspect to getting out and traveling in earnest and really being a seeker of life. And so there's even some sacred texts and some more spiritual readings, as well as the practical and poetic readings.
Very cool. Yeah, it comes across that you read a tremendous amount, and you're always kind of bringing in new knowledge. And I know through Twitter and your blog, you're frequently sharing quotes that you find and knowledge. I've got a ton more questions for you, but I do this call just to remind you guys, this is your time to speak directly with Rolf if you've got questions for him. We have one student who's queued up with a question, so I want to bring her on. And yeah, just as a reminder to you guys, if you do have questions, don't be shy, hit *2, and that'll show me that that'll flag you, so I can bring you on the line and you can ask your question directly. So let me just bring on Barbara here.
Hello.
Hi Barbara, how are you?
Hello Barbara.
I'm good, how are you?
I'm good.
You can hear me, okay? I'm in Chiang Mai in northern Thailand.
Terrific. I wish I was there, actually.
Oh, you just missed a great festival.
Yeah, Loy Krathong.
Yeah,
up there.
I love
there's a delay, so I'll talk slowly. I have three questions.
Okay.
The first one is, could I interview you for a travel feature I'm writing in the next fortnight?
I guess I'll just jump in on when you ask each question. And yeah, absolutely. Is it video or print? I'll answer that right now. If it's an email interview, just send me an email at rolf@rolfpotts.com. And if it's a recorded one, that would be a little bit more complicated. Probably also just email me at rolf@rolfpotts.com and we'll sort out the details. But I'm happy to do it.
Excellent. It's for a magazine feature, so no video.
Great.
Excellent. Now, for my next question, I have been a journalist for a long time. And I've got a new goal now, which is to get a book deal. So things have changed a lot since you wrote your first book. If you were starting out now, what would your strategy be to get a book deal and an agent?
Right. Getting an agent is pretty straightforward. I don't know if that's changed a whole lot. It's just a matter of outlining your book, writing a few sample chapters, maybe putting together a marketing plan, and then finding agents who have the same kind of writers as you are. You know, somebody who, if it's a book about travel, find some agents who have represented travel writers who write in the same way as you, and then pitch them with that, with some sample chapters and an outline and a marketing plan for your book. And it's sort of a quality of idea and quality of writing type thing. And I've found that agents, it's always hard to find the right agent for you, but agents are always looking for new clients. And so there's going to be a lot of busy work finding the right agent and finding someone who is into your ideas and you communicate with. And in fact, I worked with an agent for my first two books who I don't work with anymore just because I felt like we didn't communicate very well, and a different agent could have been working for me a little bit better. As far as the book itself, I think a lot more is required of writing books these days, in that you sort of have to be your own marketer. I mean, your agent and publicist will help you a little bit, but to a big extent, you have to promote yourself, and that means maintaining the blog and you don't have to, but it helps to have a social media community and and sort of putting stuff out there, basically free content to get people interested in your world and sort of establish yourself as an expert in what you're talking about. And this is something that goes all the way back to like Rick Steves, who was working on his brand before there was the internet. And he would go out and just in Seattle where he lived and give free talks and just establish himself as the guy who, you know, shoestring travel in Europe better than anybody else. And over time it worked out. So having said all that, probably the short answer is just write well. You know, master your sentences and paragraphs and chapters. Master your subject matter. I'm not sure what your book is about, but make sure that you know that topic inside and out, and you write about it in an engaging way with a lot of personality and a lot of usefulness. And it'll come through. And one final thing before I'll let you get the follow-up questions if you want, is that the way things are being communicated is different now. And a lot of people are getting book deals through blogs. It's a different gamble. You know, I guess you can monetize a blog these days, but I know people who've gotten travel books and books in all sorts of genres just by going online, creating a really engaging blog that really brings a certain aspect of the world to light, and that gives them a platform from which to pitch. And that's something that's come up in the last 3 to 5 years. So, but I'll let you ask your third question or follow-up question to that if you want.
Oh, okay. I was just going to comment that, yeah, I have two friends who've just gotten book deals. One who self-published and promoted the hell out of it, and 2 weeks later got a deal from Penguin, I think. And another friend who's had a very successful blog for 5 years and just got a book deal. But I have no patience to wait 5 years. The other question I had was related, and it was about that whole concept of generating a buzz or a personal brand. What publications or outlets you'd recommend to try and get to pitch to generate that buzz? Because I'm Australian. I know the Australian market, the US market, I know is huge. That's the one you've got to break, but I don't know it that well.
Right. There's old school bricks and mortar publications, you know, from the age in Australia, to The Guardian in the UK, to, you know, the San Francisco Chronicle in the US. But old media, I don't know, I think it's better to, I think the future is in new media, and it's not a matter of, I think old media is good as a legitimizer, having a byline from The Guardian or The Australian or The Chronicle or The New York Times is great as a legitimizer for your brand. But as far as getting raw eyeballs out there, often it's a matter of networking sort of in the, like maybe in the social media or travel blogging community, or even sort of the greater lifestyle design community or the health and wellness community. And a lot of that is blog driven these days. And even if you write a really fantastic article for The Guardian, and again, these national boundaries between Australia and, you know, the English-speaking world are less important now because you can just as easily read a well-written story online, and it doesn't matter where it came from. But even if you do write, say, for The Guardian, to help create your brand these days, you'll want to make sure and just really promote that link in your social media, on your blog. Try and get some follow-up and make it easy for people to find you if they want to do an interview or if they want to think, wow, this person really knows a lot about Chiang Mai or this aspect of travel or this aspect of lifestyle. And then basically you're just making it easy for people to come to you, and people are comfortable with you as the expert. And you said you don't want to wait 5 years, but I don't think there's any guarantee for anyone that this can happen overnight. I mean, it can happen overnight. I spent 5 years on my writing and just got nowhere. But then once my foot got in the door, it exploded. You know, I went from my first published article to my first published book in less than 2 years. So don't be too demoralized by the timeline. Just concentrate on doing good work and getting your name out there. So did that answer your questions?
Yes. Very helpful. Sorry for me being impatient.
Well, I think it's normal. That's a normal way to feel, especially when you're younger, you know. And I spent a lot of, because I was also impatient. Okay. Well, I mean, the 20s was when I started, and when I was, you know, swinging for the fences, to use a metaphor for a game I don't play in Australia. And I was hoping things would happen very quickly. And I think I spent a lot of time being unnecessarily frustrated, because it wasn't a matter, I think it, looking back, it wasn't important how fast it happened, but that I got that depth of expertise and I spent the time and had those important failures that made me just a just a stronger voice and a better expert when it came to finally having my books and having my big successes as a writer. So I think you can be optimistic. Be optimistic but patient, because sometimes it does take a while.
Yeah, I just know I've got to earn enough money to support my family. I should tell you one more thing, fan thing. I read your book in Singapore after being traveling for 4.5 years, and I gave it to a friend who just was retrenched, and he was very depressed. And so he decided to send his dog back to the UK, pack up his wife and baby, and go traveling.
Terrific. And is he having a good time?
Oh, they haven't left yet. They're still packing up their Singapore house.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Sometimes, actually, I go back to read Vagabonding to remind myself why it's important. You know, I think anybody in any situation can sort of get entrenched, and it's good to give yourself perspective. And actually, speaking of perspective, you know, supporting your family and things like that, I recognize that. But writing or media of any kind, especially here in the 21st century, it's a tough nut to crack financially. And it's almost like being, a musician or something. You sort of have to keep a day job or another revenue stream until writing can support you, because it's just not a stable and steady and predictable job. So,
I know that. I've been doing it for other people for 15 years.
Ooh, yeah.
I've always been scared to freelance, but now I just think the working for other people will kill me if I continue. So I quit a month ago and moved to Chiang Mai.
Okay. That is, I love that. And again, I said, I'm jealous because I love Chiang Mai myself. One thing I'll recommend to you that you might enjoy reading is a book called Travel Writing 2.0 by Tim Leffel, L-E-F-F-E-L. And for someone who wants to be sort of a post-freelancer or sort of a 21st century freelancer, someone who wants to build their own brand and maybe get a little bit, sort of own your own content better, maybe monetize a blog, his book, Travel Writing 2.0, is a good book to read to sort of get yourself into the mindset of the 21st century freelancer.
Mm-hmm. Because I see that there's a lot of unpaid work, like the Huffington Post and Matador Network and Boots and All in the UK, and I don't know the value of doing that work for free.
Well, that's a tough, I guess it's just brand building, and it's not the 1980s where you could just sort of put your clips together and then be working $1 or $2 a word gigs indefinitely with certain editors at certain glossy magazines. I'm not against working for free, and any of the outlets that you mentioned are reputable outlets. The Huffington Post, there's plenty of criticism that can be leveled at the Huffington Post. But again, that's all a matter of brand building and getting your audience out there. And where in the 1980s it used to be about getting paid by the word and having a very stable career, now it might be, you know, you give some content away for free because it helps build your brand, and then you're working with multiple kinds of you sort of have to be more of a business person in the 21st century and have multiple streams of income. And I'm a comparatively stable writer, but I still make a lot of my money through speaking or through teaching, as well as freelancing, just because it's a pretty tenuous career if you're freelancing. And if I was only freelancing, I would be doing a lot of writing that I'm not interested in doing. So again, that Travel Writing 2.0 book will help you conceptualize this, but think of yourself as a business person and really organize your life in such a way that you're not dependent on a certain aspect of your universe. I mean, set up camp in Chiang Mai and get a job as an English teacher or something, or do some import-export. Okay. I know some top-level journalists who keep, I do quite a bit of teaching, and they keep asking me for tips about getting into teaching. Because even for people who are contributing editors at Outside Magazine, they have to put two and two together as well. If they have a family and kids, they have to think of ways to stabilize their income streams. And in this day and age, for better or worse, that means cultivating multiple income streams. So, and being your own business manager.
That's what I'm working on. Thank you.
Cool. Sure. Hey, thanks for joining us, Barbara. It's good to have you on the calls again.
Thank you.
Thanks. Let's see. I've got one more question here from Andre. Sent this in, and he said, "Can you give us any tips on how to avoid looking like a cash machine for the locals, not to be seen as a tourist full of money?" I know the feeling. Mm. Yeah, I know you've traveled Asia quite a lot, and I know, in my experience in Southeast Asia, you do kind of have that feeling, like, I don't know, do you have any thoughts on that, how to kind of avoid just being a walking dollar sign?
Right, well up front I'll say that there's an extent to which you'll always be a walking dollar sign, especially if you are a white American or white Australian in places where you are obviously an outsider. If you're in Bangladesh or Zimbabwe or Paraguay, and you're obviously from out of the country, then the fact that you're there means that you have enough thousands of dollars to fly yourself down there and have a little bit of leisure time. And so there's no perfect foolproof way of avoiding the walking dollar sign conundrum. One thing I will say is, in general, not just for the walking dollar sign aspect, but also just for, safety and security, leave your bling at home. Your jewelry, your nicer clothes, even your travel boutique clothes. Most of your electronics, I know electronics are a lot bigger part of how people travel these days, but the less you show off your ostentation, the less you get bothered and the less you'll be part of the pickpockets and petty crime. So dress down, dress casual, and just sort of present yourself in a casual way. And again, to the extent that means at times you can avoid the travel boutique wardrobe that might label you as a tourist. But again, you're an outsider, people are going to recognize you as a tourist no matter what you look like. So maybe another big piece of advice on this topic is to avoid tourist zones, because tourist zones are just places where a lot of tourists go, and I'm not saying that you should avoid them all the time, because these are the places that we dream about when we travel. I mean, you're not going to go to China and avoid the Great Wall, or go to Peru and avoid Machu Picchu just on principle. Go to those places, but just understand that when you go to those places, that of course you're a walking dollar sign, because you're a big part of the economy of that place. And I found that you tend to be hassled less in the middle of nowhere than you are in the middle of the tourist trail, simply because there's no tourist economy there. People don't have that Pavlovian association that says, tourist equals money for me. And that just means that your interactions with people are going to be a lot more genuine, I think. People will have more natural curiosity instead of transactional curiosity. Another thing to keep in mind is it can be irritating, but that's part of people's livelihood. And it's pretty easy to politely, tell them you're not interested in whatever they're trying to sell you. Those would probably be my three big things. One, dress down, don't be too ostentatious, leave your bling at home. Two, get off the tourist trail. and you know, seek out slower, more organic training. And three, keep in mind that you're never really going to avoid that walking dollar sign thing, especially in the developing world. Maybe in countries where you can blend in, it'll be a different issue. But in poorer countries, it's just something that's bound to happen sooner or later.
Yeah, that's great advice. I think, yeah, I agree with you. I know a lot of times, I mean, yeah, as a tourist or an expat, like, you know, we are contributing, you know, in an important way to the local economy. And that's kind of, it's often what makes travel fun and worthwhile and interesting. But yeah, it's a lot more fun to get off the tourist trail, as you say, and have more authentic interactions. That leads into one other question that I had emailed into us. They said, our student said, I'd like to travel to places that are not full of tourists and where I can find a non-commercialized or unique experience. Can you give any specific recommendations of places to visit? And then he said, or if not, is there a general rule of thumb that you use so you don't end up on the tourist trail?
I can give a general rule of thumb easier than places to visit, because there's that catch-22 that once I start saying places to visit, then pretty soon
you give it away.
Attracting people. I mean, that's something that travelers have been sort of gnashing their teeth about for a long time. I guess the rule of thumb, the good news is that it's actually really easy to get off the beaten path, and that, you know, I say this a lot, that the parity of the Champs-Élysées, there's a lot of outlet stores, you know, it seems like a shopping mall at times, but walk 10 or 15 blocks in almost any direction and you're going to find a more authentic part of Paris. So you don't need to parachute yourself into the middle of nowhere just to get off the tourist trail. Sometimes being off the tourist trail is just being counterintuitive, because I think as travelers we naturally tend to go towards attractions, you know, I'm saying that with air quotes, and we also tend to gravitate towards other travelers. And so sometimes getting off the beaten path is just going against those instincts. It's going to that bus station in Thailand, and instead of going to a place that you've heard about and has been recommended and other travelers have told you about, go to a place that you have no idea what's going on there. And it's really a matter of challenging your comfort zone. About 10 years ago, an anthropological study was done of backpackers in Central America. And all of them had the same complaints, and they all valued the same thing, which is being off the beaten path and meeting local people. But the more that this anthropologist talked to the travelers, the more she realized that this was more of a rhetorical thing than something that people were willing to do. But at the end of the day, it was sort of this, people like to sit around other backpackers in backpacker ghettos, basically, and sort of talk about getting off the beaten path. But actually, the people who were willing to risk loneliness, who were willing to risk uncertainty, was quite small. And so that rule of thumb is a matter of, okay, so I'm not going to be there for the beautiful sights. I'm not going to see as many cool backpackers to party with. I'm going to be alone. I'm going to be opening myself up to my environment. I'm going to be putting my smartphone away and just sort of walking around in a strange environment. And so I guess my advice for the off the beaten path is sort of tough love advice, which says, look, just as soon as you let your comfort zone down, you'll be getting off the beaten path. And that means not going to places that simply aren't in your guidebook, that you've never heard of. And often I'm from Kansas, I use that as a metaphor, that everybody, people go to the United States, Europeans go to the United States, and they'll end up going to Vegas or Florida or New York. And it's like, well, go to Kansas. You know, people say it's boring, but what does that mean? You know, and so in the United States, Kansas is this obvious, off the beaten path place that for the traveler is full of a lot of surprises and it's unexpected, because you go there, you're challenging your comfort zone. It's not necessarily going to be a fantastic party, and that can apply to many places. Just go, be counterintuitive, go against your own comfort, and be open to your surroundings. Yeah.
I think there's an appeal for maybe not all travelers, but definitely a lot of us. You know, there's an appeal to both sides of things, both having an authentic interaction with like the local people who are frequently, not always, but frequently kind of from a very drastically different background and culture, you know, and learning something new in that setting, but also the other end of the spectrum, connecting with other travelers who also tend to be from, you know, different places around the world and learning and having, you know, different experiences with them. Do you, on your travels, like, is there a balance between those two things? Has there been a balance between those two things, or do you tend to really just spend more time trying to engage one-on-one, like with the people that are from the places that you visit?
I think if you're seeking to get off the beaten path in the sense that I said, there will be a balance, because I think it's very natural and normal, A, to go to popular touristed places, and I have nothing against them. I'm a fan of getting off the beaten path, but I'm also a fan of popular attractions, because I think popular attractions have a lot to say about their own local culture, and every over-touristed spot is over-touristed in a way that's unique to itself. But then also, I think it's so natural to fall in with other travelers that's something that's good. Even if you're trying with all your might to get off the beaten path, you're going to be hanging out with travelers anyway, you know. Nobody spends 100% of their time off the beaten path, you know, completely interacting with locals. I mean, that's very rare unless you, like, totally immerse yourself and learn the local language and commit yourself to a single town. If you're traveling from town to town, you know, if you're moving along after, you know, a week or so, then inevitably you're still going to be in that travel circle. And I think you're right. You know, part of the joy of travel is hanging out with someone from Norway when you're in India, or hanging out with somebody from Israel when you're in Australia, or your fellow Americans or whatever. And that's fun, but I just think that that's such a natural part of travel that it's going to happen anyway. You don't have to try hard to hang out with your fellow travelers, but you do sort of have to try hard to get off the beaten path, because it's easier to talk about it than it is to actually do it. Because I think that people talk about a place getting contaminated and a place being less authentic, and again, I'm using air quotes. But oftentimes, it's a matter of an off the beaten path becomes popular because it's less touristed, but then the very people who go there suddenly want their amenities. They want their warm showers, they want their whatever, their banana pancakes, right? And then that starts to transform the place. So it's this ongoing cycle of tourist desire versus tourist reality. I'm a big fan. I have nothing against the beaten path with other travelers, but those are natural. Those are really easy and fun patterns to get into. And where you have to challenge yourself is actually getting away from those into more authentic experiences, because, you know, anybody can have a conversation with a Thai bartender, a taxi driver, but, you know, meeting, you know, the school teacher, the truck driver, whoever, somebody who's not attached to the tourist trade, is just a harder thing to do, because it's really easy and comfortable to get stuck in that tourist trail.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, you do hear people on occasion talk a lot about, yeah, authenticity and yeah, sometimes attributing values, like this place feels more authentic, quote-unquote, as you say, than another place. But it's interesting, just that whole balance and dynamic of how travel and tourism and travelers, you know, we change the places we go to. And it, one really isn't necessarily less authentic than the other, but, yeah, trade and travel and the interaction itself, it's been going on for centuries and centuries, but it changes and evolves the places themselves. You're coming through great, the connection wise, but it is just a little bit echoey, just FYI. But I want to bring on, I've got two more questions lined up for you, so let me bring on Craig.
Hi, thanks, Cody. Hi, Rolf. It's good to listen to you. I've been following your stuff for a while, and it's really cool to chat. But my question is, it's less about the traveling and more about your workflow. So I apologize if you've already talked about this. But I'm really curious. You've been working on this stuff for years, over a decade, right? And I really want to know how you, I guess, balance the work that you put through what motivates you, I guess, to keep on going, keep on traveling, and keep on writing? I guess not the traveling part, but just to keep on working, because you seem to be at a level where you're doing what you want to do, but you keep producing new things. And I sort of, once you get to a certain level, what makes you want to keep going and keep pushing? And what sort of internal, I guess, thing, or what's the knack that you have and other people like you have that gets you guys to just keep on pushing and keep on working for greatness or whatever?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think this might sound simplistic, but to an extent, it sort of has to be about the love of doing it. Travel and writing is sort of a marriage of two obsessions for me. And so that has always made it, I guess, easy. I mean, it's never easy. No big creative endeavor is ever easy. But it's made it smooth things in that, I do what I love. I'm sort of marrying my passion in travel and writing. Interestingly, it never gets easy. You know, it never gets automatic. And maybe that's a good thing. You know, nobody wants to sort of be on autopilot. But even this week, man, I'm sort of pulling my hair out, wondering why I'm not a better, more disciplined producer. So discipline in a freelance way is an ongoing challenge, you know, especially in this day and age when there's a million distractions to be had. And I have sort of a monkey brain, which is good for me creatively, because I can, my imagination will drift into other places and I can make connections, and through this connection, that I might not if I was more directly focused. But the downside of having a monkey brain is that sometimes it can take me forever to get a project done. And so I think that every personality is different, but Annie Dillard, who's a fantastic writer, who's written a lot, a little bit about travel, but also about spirituality and about just life in general, has talked about how a schedule is a net for catching days. And even if you have a wide open life and you're living in Cape Town or Rio or Chiang Mai, having a schedule and being hard on yourself and, you know, making yourself abide by that schedule is a good way to make the most of your days. And I think there's more happiness to be had through that sort of discipline. I mean, having a beer, overlooking the Mekong, at the end of a day where you've done some exercise and you've done some work and you've answered some emails and you've exercised your creative mind, is more rewarding than having a beer on the Mekong after you've sat in a hammock and taken a nap and farted around on YouTube and things like that. it's an extent to which I feel like I'm talking out of my ass, because I can really be an undisciplined person sometimes, and it's a constant struggle, and I've been doing it for a long time. But I think just a matter of keeping that schedule, challenging yourself mentally, staying healthy physically, and just not being hard on yourself, and I don't mean stressing yourself out, but sort of applying that schedule onto yourself and challenging yourself. And as a writer, and I'm not sure quite exactly what discipline you're doing, but as a writer, there's a constant... As a writer, your market research is reading. So I'm constantly reading articles, reading books, seeing what people are saying, doing research. And so I guess the short answer would be it's part schedule and in part passion. And I think unless you're doing something that you're passionate about, and if you're a writer, unless you're writing about something you're passionate about, then it's just going to be another job. And so it's a meshing of that passion and that discipline. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, for the most part. I guess I'll be brief, but yeah, so I met Cody in Bangkok. I've been living in Bangkok for a while, and I sort of live that same sort of lifestyle where I run my own business for a while and travel and actually have beers on the Mekong after living in hammocks and not YouTube. I don't like that, but the same sort of idea that you were talking about. And just recently I started feeling the business has gotten to a level where, you know, money's okay, clients are coming in okay, I do education stuff. So everything sort of is good, you know, and I was sort of wrestling over the last few, maybe month and a half to sort of find new projects, and I feel like I'm forcing projects just to keep myself busy. When for all intents and purposes, I could go, you know, I could go to Summit or Samui for the weekend if I really wanted to, but I don't because I feel like I need to, be working, even though the work that I'm doing is more, maybe ancillary because the business itself is running, sort of on its own. And so I'm sort of figuring out, like, once you hit, like, maybe once you wrote your book and it turned into the success that it is, how did you find, like, okay, I could just chill and do nothing for a while and sort of live my life and hang out with friends or whatever. But you don't. You keep working, you know, and you get better or whatever. And so I sort of, you know, I'm just as undisciplined as you, I'm sure. I just wanted to know what you did to keep going once things started working well.
Yeah, well, I think it can be a project by project thing, and I think it might be sort of a gut, a go with your gut thing. Like if some of these projects you're taking on seem tangential, I mean, if it starts to bother you and you start getting bored with them and you start dreaming about going to Kusumui, then maybe that's your gut telling you that maybe this is unnecessary work. But at the same time, if you're spending all your time at Kusumui and you're sort of feeling ambivalent about that, then maybe you should get back to work. And I think it's a personality by personality thing. You know, my brother-in-law is a guy who he always has to be doing something. If he's not working at a job, then he has to be working on the project at home or cooking up some dinner or going for a walk or something. And I'm not that way. I'm a little bit of a dreamer and staring off into space and goofing off. Yeah. And so I think I was at the front end of my writing career when I was really interested about getting my foot in the door. I was a hardworking guy, like for about 2 years. And then there came a point after Vagabond came out and after I had had this level of success with, you know, as a journalist and a writer, I realized, hey, maybe I don't need to be Mr. Super Achiever guy. Maybe I can relax and sort of enjoy the spoils of success and read some books I hadn't been able to read and like, you know, diversify my love life a little bit and be less of this, you know, loner workaholic guy. And then I went through a phase where I was a lot more chill, and I think in the last few years I've sort of felt the pang of needing to work harder. It's like I've needed a big project to center myself. And so I think I'm actually going the other way now. I'm going back to where, okay, maybe I need to tighten the screws and work hard again. But that's very much specific to my personality. And so I don't know if I can be prescriptive to you necessarily, because it is a gut level thing and it's about what makes you happy. And sometimes it's not a matter of having a perfect system that works every time, but sort of being aware of when you're feeling angsty and trying to create a balance, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense. It just depends on what makes you happy as long as everything else is going well. Cool. I just wanted to know your process, and you answered it, so thanks so much.
Cool.
Thank you, Craig.
Yeah, thanks, Craig. All right.
No problem, man.
And next up, let me bring on Andre, who's got a question. Hopefully. There we go. Hey, Andre.
Hello?
Oh, Marta.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, it's Marta.
How are you?
Hello. Fine, very well. Well, I just wanted to say that I finished your book this week, and I really felt identified with it. And you have a chapter about coming home and how your friends find it difficult, your friends not to make you understand, and they never understand your adventures or that things. But I wanted to ask you maybe some tips of how to say to your family and friends that you're leaving for a while and you don't know when you will come back and you will be vagabonding, no? How do you make them understand that?
Right, yeah, that's a good question. I think one thing to keep in mind up front is that you'll probably, like especially with parents and mothers in particular, you'll never be able to convince them to their satisfaction that this is a perfectly safe and enriching and, you know, wonderful endeavor, because I think parents are sort of warriors by nature. And so there's an extent to which you sort of have to be the parent and just say, it's going to be okay, it's in control, and sort of help reassure them in a way that a parent might reassure a child that that this upcoming year, or however long you're going to travel, is actually going to be a good experience. And I think one reason why family members might be nervous about a daughter or a son of somebody traveling is that they think that it's either dangerous or irresponsible. And just being very honest about what your goals are can help, because I think everybody's worst nightmare is that you're going to be off someplace, you know, on the business end of a bong 8 hours a day, partying all night, just ruining your life, right? Well, everybody likes to party on the road, but you can have a lot of fun on your travels and still enrich your life, and that's what you need to sort of reassure your parents is going to happen. And so just sit down and be very honest about where you want to go. Maybe invite them to meet you someplace. I've had some really fun adventures with my parents, actually. With friends, sometimes friends might be a little bit jealous. I think everybody's a little bit nervous about travel. So family or friends say, look, you know, I'll be in Egypt in 6 months, and we should make plans to get together. And people get excited about that. They might be nervous at first, but maybe think of ways to include them on your trip. If not physically, it's hard to physically include them on a trip, but psychically. Maybe put up a blog or tell them you're going to Skype them once a week, or send them some nice emails and some pictures. And I think they'll get excited about it. But just keep in mind that part of it is letting go, you know, that you don't want to be beholden to the mother who wants you to send her an email every day or Skype 3 times a week. Part of the joy of traveling is being away from the people that you're close to. So I guess it's just a matter of reassurance, because those people in your world don't want you not to travel. They just want to be reassured that you're going to be okay, and that's pretty easy to do. So does that answer your question, or do you have more specific concerns?
No, it was that, just how you manage, or any tip you have. I know it's tough, no? And maybe after that, when they see you that you're happy and you have a successful business or whatever, they calm down. But the step before you travel, I find it here difficult in Spain, because families are like very close and not so open-minded, and they don't really get why you want to travel around the world for a long time and be like vagabonding, no? It was just some tips, but it's okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it's a legitimate question, and I think it does come to down to reassurance. Actually, vagabonding is really popular in Italy, which is also a family-oriented country. And a lot of my vagabonding sales have been to people who bought it for their parents to say, look, you know, it's not this irresponsible, dangerous thing. It's actually this thing that can be a part of my life. And again, it's another thing that I don't think there's ever going to be a perfect answer to your family. There's going to be an extent to which you're just going to have to pat your mom on the head, tell her you love her, and say, you know, tough, I'm leaving, I love you, and I'll keep in touch, but this is something I'm going to do. Because I've known people who put off travel for far too long because they're afraid of making family members nervous, when in fact it's easier to just tear off the Band-Aid, to use an American metaphor, you know, to get that pain over with and then enjoy your travel and sort of force your family to realize that it's actually a good thing.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks,
Mark. Yeah, good luck.
Thanks for joining us,
Mark. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, that's great advice for Marta and everyone else. Give them your copy of Vagabonding. I never did that. I didn't think of that, but I should have done that before leaving, was give that to my grandmother.
Yeah, it happens a lot. It's funny. It's not like I wrote it with that in mind, but it's become this little ancillary market for it that people, it's so hard to explain, because I guess people have stereotypes about what travel is going to be like, and so they just buy a Vagabonding for their parents, and I've actually gotten emails from parents who are saying, you know, thank you, this was very reassuring. I never realized that travel was this, you know, could be this rich of an experience. And I think some parents have actually been turned into vagabonders because their parents, because their kids sort of spread the word.
Yeah. Well, hey, I know we're coming up on the hour, and I know how busy a guy you are, so if you need to jet off, just let me know. But would you have maybe 5 or 10 more minutes for a couple more questions?
Yeah, sure. Let's...
I've got
One or two more questions to do.
Yeah, I have one more that our student Tom emailed in to us. He was asking about the No Baggage Challenge. I know you did this No Baggage Challenge in 2010, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that this is, I think, did you start this of your own accord, and you visited 5 continents in 12 countries?
Yes, 6 weeks.
I know Scotty Vest, I believe, was one of your sponsors, and then they picked up and started sending other people on similar challenges after you initiated the project. But what gave you the idea for this no baggage world travel thing, and why in the heck did you want to do it?
Right. I've always had this whimsical notion since I was, like, really young, since I was first thinking about travel, of just sort of wandering the earth with nothing, you know, with the things in my pocket. But there's a certain impracticality to that. And I've always been a proponent of traveling light, which sometimes as a writer can be hard to do because, you know, you have to carry a laptop much of the time or research materials. And so I always had it in the back of my head as just sort of this wacky, you know, stunt, this wacky adventure. See if you can try it. And I didn't think about it that seriously until I know some other people were doing it. Specifically, one of my bloggers wrote about this guy, Jonathan Nevin, a few years ago, who had been doing some no baggage travel experiments in Central America. And it just seemed... What he said about no baggage travel, it seemed so sensible. It just seemed like it was less of a stunt, less of a challenge than you might think. But I sort of never got around to doing my own experiment until Scotty Vest sent me some promotional materials about their clothing and offered to send me some samples. And, you know, I get that all the time. As a travel writer, I get a lot of promotion. But it just sort of clicked that, hey, well, maybe this is my chance to finally do this no baggage experiment. So I said, you know, I got in touch with Scotty Vest and said, why send me the clothes? Why just send me the clothes when you can send me around the world with the clothes? And so I got into talks with him, and I got into talks with Buchanal, who I've been working with for a long time, and Buchanal.com, the wonderful travel community. And it turned into this very public, sort of real-time experiment. I got a cameraman, Justin Globe, who did a terrific job with the videos. And it became a chance, A, to sort of realize this little childhood daydream of traveling with no baggage, and two, to sort of have an extreme example of something that of a lesson I try to teach through vagabonding, which is this traveling life, not only on the road, but at home, that like things, physical things can only get in the way of your travels, literally and metaphorically, to weigh yourself down with things on the road or at home. And so, so it became this public experiment and demonstration of hyper-minimalism. And it ended up being a lot of fun and a lot easier than I expected. You know, it was, I mean, for drama purposes, maybe if I had been, you know, breaking down and weeping or having any horrible challenges with no luggage, it would have been more drama. But it ended up, once I got into the rhythm of traveling with no baggage, it ended up being pretty easy. And there were moments when it was extraordinarily nice to have nothing, you know, be able to do, to go in any direction at any moment. I don't know that I'm always going to be a no-baggage traveler, because I think you can apply those ultra-minimalist principles with a day pack, for example. But it ended up being a lot of fun and easier than I expected, and I think it's fun that that through Scotty Vest or through independent projects, people are still experimenting with that. Because I guess the point I was trying to get a lot, the point I was trying to get across wasn't, look, nobody should take bags, but look, you know, if I can travel with no bags, then you can travel with one bag, for example. And it's just, it's more enriching, and it's actually easier in some ways to go light.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so Tom wrote in, and he said, I enjoyed the No Baggage Challenge. Are you still taking it to the extremes of No Baggage? I think you addressed that, but he asked, he did ask, what items do you now travel with and consider absolutely essential?
Very few, actually, are essential. And I encourage people to experiment in this regard, to take, you know, to start your trip with 20 items, and then if you find that you're not using an item, give it away, mail it home, you know. So let me think. The very basic minimum of clothes, a few rotations of socks and underwear and T-shirts, you know, some quick-dry travel pants, basic toiletries, you know, toothbrush, toothpaste. You don't have to, but I'm a fan of guidebooks. Either you can put a guidebook on your smartphone or your iPod, or you can bring a physical paper book. I think the essentials are just clothes on your back, hygiene to keep you from being, you know, completely disgusting, and then go out and really travel is about the experiences in front of you, you know, not the gear that you're dragging behind you. So if you're big on photography, then bring a camera. That's great. I these days tend not to bring a camera at much of the time. But past those bare minimum clothing and cleaning yourself things, I think there's not anything that is absolutely necessary. But I'm not going to knock somebody if they, you know, have certain items that they can't live without. Sunscreen, a hat, you know, sunglasses, things to contend with the weather. But I encourage people to really challenge themselves to be as minimal as possible, because I think oftentimes we end up as travelers, you know, dragging around these items that we use once a week and we could probably do without. So, again, my No Baggage Challenge was as metaphorical as it was travel, or as it was practical. It was a matter of getting myself and others to think, well, what do I really need? And I found that it's not that much. So, instead of thinking, I think coming, the bare minimum is a person-by-person thing, and trial and error is a great way to really challenge yourself into figuring out what your bare minimum is.
Yeah. All right, well, two very quick last questions that I have for you, both about, I think, two of your kind of favorite cities to spend time in. One, I was curious, you run a writing workshop in Paris every July, at least I think you still are. Can you tell us more about that? Is that, like, where are your students from, and is that something that may interest some of the DNA students who want to learn more about travel writing?
Absolutely. It's a one-month creative writing workshop at the Paris American Academy. You can find more information online at pariswritingworkshop.com, or I have links to my website at backofblogging or blogpots.com. But it's a one-month intensive creative writing workshop. And travel writing is one aspect of many. I teach travel writing, but there's also personal essay and memoir. We have novelists teaching about novel and addressing poetry and playwriting. And that's interesting. You can learn a lot about, you can enhance your travel writing actually by studying novels. So it's not necessarily a travel writing intensive course, but I think it's as valuable as a travel writing intensive course. Although if you want to just, like, in practical terms, if you want to improve your art and your craft as a writer in general, it's I think one of the best places in the world to do it, because you're in this unique situation where you're in Paris, you're around writers, and all you're doing is writing. Whereas if you're interested in travel writing from a more business aspect, I don't spend a lot of time on the business aspect of travel writing in that course. I mean, I spend, especially on my one-on-one conferences with my students, and in some of my classes I talk about the business aspect, but the point of that class is really to make people better writers. And I think we have a really great success rate in that regard. It's rare for anybody to be able to just think about writing for a month. But if you're wanting to come into travel writing from more the business aspect instead of the art and craft aspect, I do teach some travel writing, like some one-week travel writing courses at other times and other places. But I am a big fan of the program, which involves other teachers besides myself, simply because it's this totally unique situation to be in one of the most beautiful cities in the world, around like-minded people who are from all over the world. Maybe 70% Americans and quite a few Australians and Brits, but we also have people. It's English language instruction, but we have people from all over the place, from Brazil to Egypt to Norway and Germany and France and Korea and India. And so it's a very international bunch, just thinking about writing. And so in addition to increasing your craft, it's a lot of fun, too. So yeah, I recommend it to people, unless you're just there to really get it into the networking and business aspect, in which case I might recommend one of my one-week courses. And if you go to rolfpots.com/event, you can find some of those other courses. But I'm sort of compromised by saying this because I have a vested interest in the Paris program, but I'm a fan of it too. I think it's a really terrific program, and it brings in a lot of different aspects of writing. So.
Well, sounds very cool. I mean, yeah, I might have to check it out when we make a move to France. But you, man, you are just involved in all kinds of things. You are the one of the busiest people in the world, I think. my last question, though, for you was about Bangkok. I lived there for about a year and a half while I've been out here in Southeast Asia. Now I'm currently down in Krabi province near the beach in a nice big beautiful townhouse, but I was curious. I think you know you've said that Bangkok is one of your kind of favorite city hangouts. Why is that, and do you have any plans to go back soon?
I do have plans to go back. It's funny, I went back to Bangkok on the No Baggage Challenge, and it was I hadn't been there in years, and it was amazing how easy I clipped back in. And so I think, to an extent, it's a gut level thing. Is that Bangkok is just this instinctive place where I'm comfortable and my senses are engaged, and I just feel happy to be there. Even though, I mean, Bangkok is this giant, busy, polluted, crazy place with all this traffic and all this pollution. But I don't know. There's an extent to which it's intangible. But I mean, Thai people are very friendly and accommodating. It's inexpensive. There's always something going on. I guess it's just a feast for the senses. You can walk around the city and always find something new and interesting. The food is good. It's a very international city. You know, a lot of travelers are coming through. A lot of expatriates live there. And so it's just sort of a mixture of my own sensibility with my own experiences there. There's an extent to which it's hard to quantify, but it's just a place where I immediately relax. There's other cities where I'm that way. You know, Paris, New York, I like San Francisco, and Cairo to an extent. But there's something a little bit singular about Bangkok, and that it's just a place where I can relax, it's less expensive, and even if, I don't know if I really can see myself living there long term, but it's a place that will always be a hub for me, I think.
Yeah, I really enjoyed my time there. Well, let me know if you make your way back out to Thailand or maybe to Bali as well in the next 6 months or so. If you need a vacation, it'd be cool to meet up in person. To sign off, is there anything in your pipeline coming up soon that you want to tell people about? And where can our folks find you online if they want to learn more?
I have a lot of things in the pipeline as usual. I'm in Philadelphia for a while. I'm going to be teaching at the University of Philadelphia in the spring. Some of those events are open to the public. So if any of you are passing through Philly in the next 3 to 6 months, shoot me an email or touch base on Facebook. Online, you can find me at rolfpots.com, which links to my other site, vagabonding.net, is my book website. You can find me on Twitter at rolfpots. I don't tweet a whole lot, but I usually put a few pithy quotes up there. I'm going to be going to Mongolia in June. I'll be teaching some classes in the spring. I have like three book ideas percolating, but I'm not sure which one is going to come out first and when that's going to happen. So just if you're curious about that, just drop into my website every once in a while. And then as we were talking about before, you can find me every July in Paris, which is a terrific city, and it's a terrific writing course to be a part of. So I'm rare in that I know what I'm going to be doing 6 months from now. Usually I don't, but if you're ever curious about what I'm going to be up to in coming months, just go to worldclass.com and specifically the events page or my blog to find out what I'm up to.
Great. Well, hey, Rolf, I just want to say personally, thank you very much for a truly inspiring book. It was, as I said, it was one of two books that I read before I kind of drastically changed my life. And so thank you for that and for your great writing all over the place, and especially for, being very generous with your time and sharing your stories with us today. It's really, really great to speak with you one-on-one. So thank you so much.
You bet. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Well, take care. I hope you have a great day. And to all the students on the line, thank you guys for joining us on the live call. And you'll get details soon, and I'll see you next week for the next one. Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Take care.
Thanks, Rolf. Bye-bye.